Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and if I had a nickel for every time Christopher Nolan made a movie about an army stuck on a beach or one that featured Matt Damon just trying to get home, I'd have four nickels, which is not very many nickels, but it's weird that it happened collectively four times. Joining me today is Devinder Hardawar.
You're telling me this is a movie about an odyssey by a guy named Odysseus? There's a mentor named Mentor, some lazy writing Homer.
And Jeff Cannata.
Forgive the baseball analogy, but it's Nolan with a Homer at the box office.
Wow.
I will say That's we great. Don't actually know that as of this recording.
Oh, I think we know that. I'm putting money down. I'm putting money down based on my crowd reaction last night at a, you know, it was a critic plus public screening, eruptions. People cheering, hooting and hollering. The people want to see The Odyssey.
I will say, first of all, those are all vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing The Odyssey. That is primarily what we're going to be doing this week. We're recording this review early, so there's not going to be any what we've been watching. We'll save that for next week. But we do have just a couple of quick things to cover here at the top of the show. And of course, just want to mention, this is the Filmcast, and you can support the podcast at patreon.com/filmpodcast. But I don't know if you guys saw this, but Dennis, who runs the Summer Movie Wager website, did post, he does statistical analyses, and he posts percentage chance that everyone has of winning. As of this stage of the summer.
Oh, yeah. Movie Wager. I saw it.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay. So chances to win the 2026 Summer Movie Wager, Peter Cerretta, 44%.
God damn it.
Not a surprise. Jeff, you're muted.
Jeff, you're muted. Okay. Yeah.
I was just shouting, and I'm glad it was probably better that I was muted. Yeah, I just said, he's in the lead again. What is that?
Again.
BJ Colangelo, 22%. That would be amazing if she won. I'm rooting for her, honestly, in many ways.
Why are you rooting for her, Dave? Because your percentage chance?
Not even a percentage chance. This is the first time. Let's keep going down.
Devinder Hardawar, 14% chance of winning the Summer Movie Wager. Jermaine Lucier, 12%. Jeff Cannata, 7%. That's normal. Hmm.
And what do you Dave mean, that's Chen, normal. That's not zero.
It's not below 1%.
That's right.
Yay, full percentage points, Dave Chen, boys,
0.53% chance of winning the Summer Movie Wager.
0.53%.
Incredible.
So you're telling me there's a chance, guys. Yeah. You're telling me there's a chance. Now, according to Dennis, who, again, we really appreciate running the summermoviewager.com, I need three separate things to happen for me to win. Number one,
dogs Spider-Man, and cats living together.
Number one, Spider-Man Brand New Day coming in at number one. That's actually going to happen.
That's conceivable.
I think there's a huge chance that's going to happen. Yeah. Number two, The Odyssey coming in at number five.
No.
Which is pretty tough because so far at this point in the Summer Movie Wager, number five is The Mandalorian and Grogu with $177 million. Backrooms is $194 million. So I need to believe that The Odyssey is going to make basically less than $200 million domestic.
I'm looking at Odyssey screens right now, sold out for weeks already. So
you know what's funny is that I think, if I recall, on our Summer Movie Wager episode, we were saying this might be the first summer in a long time where everything in the top 10 is over $200 million.
Yeah.
Well, that ain't happening.
We were incredibly wrong about that. Also, Dennis says, I need Moana to basically not be in the, to be number eight or nine or outside the top 10. At present, by the way, good chance Moana is outside the top 10. So that's great.
Utterly
looking
crazy.
Forward to that. But yeah, I need to, what is it? I don't think this is drawing an inside straight. I think this is the equivalent of hitting a royal flush in poker. That's the odds I am facing right now. But anyway, right now it's a two horse race between Peter Cerretta and BJ Colangelo, as far as I'm concerned. And I know which one amazing. I'm hoping for.
Peter Cerretta must be stopped.
Anyone but him.
Anyone but him. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Thanks to Dennis for putting those statistics together. It's always a fun part of the summer. Before we get to our Odyssey review today, wanted to acknowledge a couple emails at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. A couple weeks ago here on the podcast, Jeff Cannata recounted the story of his child watching Jurassic Park and getting terrified of it and not being able to finish the film. We got several emails from people that were very, very sympathetic to that. Jolene writes into slashfilmcast@gmail.com, when my daughter was around 8 or 9 years old, I took her to see one of my all-time favorite movies, E.T. Our local theater was doing a free morning showing for kids, kids being the operative word. I was thrilled to be sharing this experience with my daughter. I could not wait for the bonding to commence. She was a little uneasy during the first 15 minutes of the movie, getting small glimpses of E.T., but not really seeing what he fully looked like. Then when Elliot and E.T. finally see each other in the cornfield and scream, my daughter said, nope. And we immediately had to leave the theater. My daughter is now 24, and not only has she never seen the rest of the movie, she still brings up how awful that experience was every time she wants to make me feel guilty. It traumatized her so much that when we went to Universal Studios in Orlando, she refused to go anywhere near the E.T. ride. So, Jeff, I share your parental pain and guilt. I hope your son recovers better than my daughter did. Jolene, hashtag my movie podcast guys, hashtag Spaghetti Club. That's a
Spaghetti
long-time
Club
reference. Callback.
Let's go, long-time Spaghetti reference. Club. Yeah. Let's go. I was 6 years old when E.T. came out, and I recall vividly, I want to say it was Father's Day, and my dad got to pick the movie that we went to see. And I desperately wanted to see, maybe conflating two moments. Forgive me. I have not checked the dates on this, but my memory tells me that I was begging to go see Star Trek II, and my dad wanted to see E.T. So the family went to see E.T. Mm-hmm. And I was utterly terrified at the beginning of that movie that I remember so vividly being on the floor of the movie theater, the sticky, candy-strewn floor of the movie theater, just hiding in those early moments where the guys with the flashlights are looking for E.T. I thought it was the scariest thing I had ever seen.
Mm. Yeah. Imagine how you would have felt during Wrath of Khan, Jeff. The thing
the
going
ear,
into the
ears. Ear slugs.
Yeah.
Ear slugs. Horrifying.
That's freaky.
I mean, that messed me up years later when I finally saw Star Trek 2.
You know what was scary for me when I was young? Neck stuff. Like something wrapping around the neck, choking off the oxygen. We definitely got a little bit of that at the beginning of Evil Dead Burn.
Yeah.
You know, like the opening scene of Evil Dead Burn would have freaking given me nightmares.
Well,
as a kid.
The entire movie of Evil Dead Burn is not appropriate for children in any
the
way.
The movie in 5 minute increments would have given me
any 2.5 minute section of Evil Dead Burn would have given you nightmares as a kid.
Would have been like, honestly, if I watched Evil Dead Burn as a kid, there would be no film cast probably.
That's right. Really? It would be also negligent parenting. But no, I totally relate to the E.T. thing because I found E.T. very terrifying. And then later on in the movie is also terrifying when the scary men in the plastic up their house and poor E.T. turns ashen.
That's the scariest part.
Oh, yeah. It's awful. It's terrifying.
It's awful.
As a kid, and Elliot is crying and distraught. And as a kid, you just relate to that little boy and you're like, I'm also crying and distraught. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a rough movie for kids. But I will say, as I mentioned on the podcast when we did it, I showed E.T. to my kids and they did not have that reaction to E.T.
Nice.
That they had to Jurassic Park. So
that is good.
I don't know.
That is good. Moving on, I want to get to this email from Joshua writing into slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Jeff's story about his son about Jurassic Park in this week's episode immediately brought to mind a deeply formative moment for me with the movie when I was a kid. I was both eccentric and deeply sensitive as a kid with a lot of undiagnosed anxiety and had very little tolerance for anything scary. And what I deemed scary was laughable to most. I had to run out of the theater in the live-action Flintstones movie at 5 years old because of Bam Bam's Rampage.
Wow.
I couldn't handle a lot of things even made for families and kids. But I had a problem. I absolutely adored dinosaurs. I was obsessed and could name 72 dinosaurs by memory by the time I was 3. And Jurassic Park was the dinosaur movie. So what did I do? I would watch it on VHS and fast forward. Much of what scared me on screen was audio-based, like music or FX or screams. And so this way I could see all the dinosaurs and not have to experience the terror. When I was 8 or 9, we rented it again. We didn't even own it. And I decided this time I would watch just the talking parts so that I could experience a little bit more of the movie. I ended up just watching the whole thing. Turns out my imagination had been far worse than what the movie actually conjured. Fast forward to today, I'm an avid horror fan and seek out movie thrills in all manner of genre. So Jeff, if you find your kiddos struggling with anything on the big screen, know that there's always hope. Thanks for all you guys do. Been a weekly listener for over 7 years now, end quote. That's from Joshua, writing to slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Fast forwarding past the scary parts. I don't know if I ever did that, but that is a very reasonable way to go about it, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeff, did that ever occur to you? Like, did you ever think, hey, let's fast forward past this part and then we can watch the rest of the Jurassic Park?
No. No, I mean, I didn't have any clue that he was freaking out until he literally leapt from his chair and fled the room. He was being very calm and, you know, there was no hints, that this part was scary or that part was scary or I'm getting uncomfortable.
He was trying to be brave. Yeah. Yeah.
And also, I don't know if I necessarily would be down for skipping the scary parts. I'm totally fine stopping the movie. If we need to stop the movie, let's stop the movie. But I don't think skipping through the scary parts is the strategy I would employ.
I mean, do you want to finish the movie or do you want your child to run out the room? Those are your choices.
Well, I'm totally fine not finishing the movie. Yeah. I mean, if you're not ready for the movie, that's fine. Mm-hmm. We can return to it at a later time or whatever. I don't know. I just feel like, I don't know.
We also did get a few questions about the fact that the movie's PG-13. And in the past, you have been reluctant to show your kids those types of movies. I am curious, like, has there been a sea change in the Kanata household around this topic? Or
no, I wouldn't say a sea change. I noted when I brought up this story that my wife is the one who decided Jurassic Park was going on. and I don't
so
even
that
think
was not a
check.
Not a
no.
Decision.
My wife has this. I love her, and this is not throwing her under the bus in any way. But honey, if you're listening, my wife has this sort of like wistful nostalgia that is not always completely shackled to fact.
Right. Like Jurassic Park, wasn't that a magical movie?
Oh.
What a magical experience that was. Right?
She literally said the words, we gotta show them the classics. And I would consider Jurassic Park a classic, so I'm not disputing that. But it's just this sort of general notion of like, Jurassic Park, that's a great kids movie. And I'm like, well, not sure.
Wow. So all it takes to do the PG-13 is Mrs. Kanata having an idea. That's
Well, most things in this house, all it takes is Mrs. Kanata having an idea. I don't know how your household works, but that's
the same. you described it in such principled terms, the whole PG-13 thing. So it's like,
I try to stay principled. And then my wife is like, it's Sunday, we're going to watch Jurassic Park. And I'm like, I'm not sure if that's okay.
Well, thank you so much for sharing y'all's experiences with being traumatized as kids by films or traumatizing your own kids. We really, really appreciate hearing them here on the Filmcast. You can always write into us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com.
This episode of the Filmcast is brought to you by Square, the business platform that helps sellers become neighborhood favorites. Whether you're gearing up for a busy season or just trying to keep up with everyday demand, Square keeps your business running smoothly. From payments and point of sale to online orders, inventory, staff, and more, all in one place. So you can focus on your customers, not your to-do list. I got to tell you, I always appreciate when a business has Square. I don't even carry cash anymore. I certainly don't even really want to worry about my credit card. I like that tap and go. It makes it easy. It makes it simple. I'm in and out. And if a business has Square, I feel like they got my back. It's easy. It's seamless. And it lets me focus on what I like about the business, not the mishigas of getting in and out. And that's from a customer standpoint. That's just me as a customer. I want that every time. But from a business perspective, Square brings payments and point of sale, inventory, staffing, all the online sales together in one system. so business owners don't have to juggle a bunch of tools. Their hardware and software are designed to be easy to use for the business owner so that day-to-day operations feel simpler. Whether you're just starting out or growing from one location to many, you can sell online, in-store, or both and customize your setup as your business evolves. It's built to support different kinds of businesses, not force everyone into the same mold. And get this, sellers who use Square's software see 9% higher sales on average. That's because people like me appreciate it and want to patronize those businesses even more. Square helps you run your business more smoothly, bringing payments, operations, and insights together in one place, so you're ready for whatever's next. Right now, listeners to the Filmcast can get up to $200 off Square hardware when you sign up at square.com/go/Filmcast. That's SQUARE.com/GO/FILMCAST. Get started with Square and build a setup that works the way you do.
All right, folks, it is time to get to our review of The Odyssey.
After years of war, no one could stand between my men.
Welcome to the Filmcast review of The Odyssey. Now, I want to just start right out the gate by letting people know that our plan for today's episode is you should assume that there are spoilers for this film from the beginning. I know what some people may be reacting to right now. How can you spoil a 3,000-year-old thing, David? I think
that's
some
what I said.
Might...
that's what I said. And anybody who comes at me,
that was not intentional.
Yeah, yeah. It was pretty spot on.
You've had your entire lives to, you know, bone up on The Odyssey. And you've probably heard a lot of these things too.
What I was going to say was that some people may find, despite like, yes, we all, I think most people know what the plot points of The Odyssey are, but even if you don't, regardless of any of that, some people might find a discussion of how exactly these things are rendered on screen to be spoilers. So I'm letting people know right out the gate. Like, if you care about spoilers, bookmark this, come back afterwards. We will start with overall thoughts and then get into spoilers, but you should assume there's going to be spoilers right from the beginning.
There's
okay.
A number of scenes where you're going to be like, they ripped this off from Star Wars.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting you say that, right? Because Christopher Nolan said that one of the reasons why he tackled this story is because it is so foundational to not only so many of his films, but to so many of the stories that we read today.
Wow.
So,
it's a human story.
It is the human story.
Yeah.
Mankind, the story. Yeah. Okay. So, all that said, we are going to talk about our overall thoughts of The Odyssey, and then I'm going to ask some questions about like specific sequences or scenes, and so it's going to get specific real quick, but let's begin. Overall, Devinder Hardwar, what did you think of Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey?
I think this movie is a masterpiece for many reasons, right? It is such a perfect pairing of director and material. Nolan has always like pushed the boundaries in terms of like what stories he's trying to tell. He's always pushed to make epics, really. And his ideas are big. I think of like, I don't know how many people would tackle something like Interstellar, like something that basically kind of reworks the way we visualize the black holes. And that something that goes so hard. Pairing him with the foundational epic of storytelling that we know, a story that's almost 3,000 years old, and a story whose influence has rippled through time. Everything you've seen and heard has The Odyssey in it. I think it's just the perfect pairing. And I was thrilled throughout this movie. I do wonder how it's going to be play for people who aren't like very aware of the story or things that happen, because it is in typical Nolan style, it's kind of like elliptically told. We don't know where we're beginning. We don't know where Odysseus is at the beginning, and slowly you start to make sense of things. But I think like by the end, even if you don't fully grasp like why the Trojan War happened or why certain things happened, the movie propels you along in a way that feels really thrilling. I saw it in a press screening, but also there was like, you know, 80% of people with screening passes, of normal people just coming to see this movie. And people were on board, clapping, shouting, like just fully into the more thrilling elements of the story, because shit gets wild. There are some incredible set pieces here. I think my main takeaway from this movie is not only did I love it, but also it feels like just a big middle finger to AI. Watching this movie, you see the sheer amount of human effort and creativity that's gone into producing this movie. They built those boats. I believe they built that Trojan horse, and it's people dragging it through the sand in the way that people used to have to drag large objects in ancient times. But even like the scope of the story, it is something that echoes through time for humanity. This was originally a spoken word poem, a spoken word epic. Homer, we just have Homer's version that was written down. So it just feels epic in ways that few things do. I also saw it in a 70mm normal screening, not IMAX, but it looked incredible. I cannot wait to see it in full frame IMAX, because I cannot imagine like just how large and how clear these images will look. So I loved everything about it, but also I'm, you know, in the target market for somebody who would love a big budget Odyssey movie, because I've studied the stuff for years. I spent time translating the Iliad and the Odyssey in high school, so I know the story. And what I love specifically is like this movie gets the poetry. There are some beautifully poetic, visually poetic moments in here that are like essential bits of reading that story too. And, you know, things that happen, like, well, as we go through, I'll point some of them out, but small things that feel so beautiful and things I remember from translating these stories. Nolan has captured those. He has done a lot to like really recreate the story in a big, bold way. And I freaking love it. I think people are going to enjoy it too.
Jeff Cannata, your thoughts on the Odyssey?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say my thoughts on the Odyssey are best summed up in the form of a limerick.
Let's hear it, Jeff.
A grand cinematic rendition of the original Man on a Mission. Some scenes I'm agog, but that first act's a slog. Can't we cut out some dry exposition?
Oh, wow.
Okay. I'm going to be the contrarian here, because I'm in shock right now. I knew this was going to happen.
There's so very little exposition. It just kind of throws you into it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Go ahead, Jeff.
I know. It's going to be pile on Jeff Day. It's okay. Yep. I can handle it. I'm going to be much cooler on this movie than you guys. Wow. I think it has major problems, major pacing problems. And I think through the first half of this movie, I was actively not liking it. And then it gets better and better and better as it goes. And by the end, it just crescendo after crescendo and undeniably spectacular and amazing. And there are moments that are just undeniably great. That said, it's way too long. Like an hour of this movie could be cut out and you would have a better movie, in my opinion. He just wants to cram in every single bit of the Odyssey, and I don't think that's necessary or additive. I mean, like, literally every scene with John Bernthal can be out of this movie and will not change anything. In my opinion. I think some of the sequences are clunky. Especially in the first half, to my mind, it feels very contemporary, and I think that's a choice. I think he's trying to sort of contemporize the storytelling of this ancient story. But I had a real adjustment period to kind of getting into how the dialogue is written and how it's directed, feeling very contemporary to me. But that said, like, I don't want to minimize just how spectacular the movie gets. And there are sequences, you know, I saw this in full screen IMAX. They claimed they were projecting it in 70 millimeter. I don't know if that's actually true, but it looks.
Yeah, a word about that. So Devendra, you saw it in 70 millimeter normal aspect ratio.
Normal aspect ratio.
And I guess.
But I heard the film reel going. I heard the projector, you know, it has that flicker of film. Yeah.
Yeah. And Jeff, if I recall correctly, you saw it, your theater is a LIMAX theater. So it's like a relatively larger screen, but not full.
It's a real big, I mean, massive screen. Yeah. Like there's IMAX here in Colorado that is, you know, real IMAX that you go in and you're like, this is IMAX? This is the one screen in Colorado, in the Denver area I know of that is, you know, 10 stories tall and you know, that's square shaped.
You saw the real IMAX,
Well, which theater was this, Jeff? Just so we, because there's been confusion about this in the past. But
I know you always want to nail me on this one. The
I don't want to nail. I just want to accurately be represent. Accurate. Like true IMAX is hard to actually find.
I'm not claiming it's a true IMAX. I did not say that. I'm saying there's an IMAX theater right down the street from my house that says it's IMAX that is not anywhere close to what I saw this in, which is much farther away. It's the United Artists Colorado Center IMAX Theater is where I saw it.
Got it. Thank you for sharing. Go ahead. I'll say, I think I had the worst experience of all of us because I saw it in it was advertised and sent out as 70 millimeter IMAX.
That's what mine was.
Yeah. 70 millimeter non IMAX. So I was like, okay, cool. At least I'll get to see it on film. There was no 70 millimeter projection on this.
Really?
Claimed it was 70 millimeter. I don't know if the theater that I was in does that, but
because I saw Oppenheimer, I saw there was no cigarette burns, and you know it's film when they need to make the changeovers. This whole thing played uninterrupted. It looked like a digital projection. It did not look like a film projection.
Did you ask them? If you ask your reps, they will tell you how it was actually projected.
Well, the reps were the ones that sent out the email about the 70 millimeter, so confirm, I didn't know if I could trust them.
Because sometimes it's like. Yeah, they say it's going to be our projector broke because that happens for every single 70 millimeter screen.
That's my guess is what happened with it. They couldn't find, you know, there's probably one projectionist in Seattle that can do this.
Yeah.
And so they probably couldn't find it or that something went wrong with the reel, but I did not see it in 70 millimeter or IMAX. So I had
You guys have vignetting on your, around the edges of the screen? It looked like an old Instagram filter where the edges are a little vignetted.
No.
I mean, not that didn't feel within the scope of the actual film.
But that could
itself.
Be if you saw it in 70 millimeter IMAX film, Jeff. That could be.
That's
part
what
of
I'm
the,
thinking. Yeah. Maybe that's proof to their claim.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm cooler on this movie than you guys, but it is undeniably a spectacle. I just think it is. It takes so long to get revved up, in my opinion. And once it's revved up and going, it's going and it's awesome. But I think a significant trim to it would make for such a more palatable experience that, you know, gets to the good stuff quicker. And the good stuff is so good. It really is, you know, putting a big ass camera in a real place and shooting real things constantly. But there are sequences, I thought I know you guys are going to disagree with me, but I thought the Cyclops sequence was not good, in my opinion. There are sequences in the early part of the movie that I just feel like, man, it's just not working for me at all. But then the movie just keeps getting, you know, keeps going. It's 3 hours. And, there are moments that are truly phenomenal and you kind of are amazed. There's very few filmmakers that could make this movie. And, it is very episodic as the Odyssey is.
Yeah.
And so I feel like certain episodes work for me and certain episodes don't. And I feel like if a more judicious cut of this feels to me like the extended edition. This feels to me like I'm watching the stuff that wouldn't normally make the theatrical cut, but because we're in IMAX town and the only chance for you to see the director's cut is in IMAX is to have it theatrically released, then we're getting that. And, you know, nobody says no to Chris Nolan. So it just feels like, man, I wish there had been more constraint on this movie a little bit on it, and it would I think be, to my mind, better. But again, don't mistake that for me not thinking that there are truly phenomenal sequences and some of the visualization. I mean, there are things that you've seen a million times, there's things you've heard about a million times, but never like this. And I think that's one of the interesting mm-hmm. things about this movie. It feels like an adaptation, and it is. It's an adaptation of a old work, but it's an adaptation that really looks at the material and attempts to do it in a completely fresh way. And I think that's the most exciting part of it, is seeing things that you know, that you've seen many, many times, done with a new eye. So I'm impressed with it. It's not my favorite Nolan movie. It's probably not going to be in my top 10 of the year, but it's an impressive piece of work for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I can hear you. I hear what you're saying, Jeff. Like, I can see the want and need for something shorter, but you know what? Not for this. The entire point of this story is the journey, is the slog, right? And it never sits down and explains, like, Odysseus went out here for this. Somebody, you know, took Helen, and then this war was launched. It never sits down and tells you everything that's happening. They do it through glimpses of scenes, glimpses of conversations, and Nolan's like elliptical editing. So I feel like if it were an hour shorter, you'd have no idea what the real motivations are for a lot of these things. So I hear you, but also, like, man, this is what 3-hour epic movies are made for. Like, this, a story like this, to me.
I will just say, I also loved the film. I also, like Devendra, think it's a masterpiece. I think that he makes some really interesting decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, on last week's podcast, Jeff, you talked about how, like, these live action Disney movies, you know, there's no take there. It's just like, we're trying to recreate
this
it.
Is a take.
This is a take.
Sure. Yeah.
This is a take. And let's talk about it. I'll just bring up a couple of things that I think are distinct about this adaptation. First of all, one of the things Christopher Nolan is known for is trying to capture everything in camera. Like, he is trying to make effects, visual effects, set pieces look as realistic as humanly possible. He has thus far not really applied that eye to fantastical things.
Sure.
Like, the closest is probably Tenet or The Prestige, maybe even. But, like, in
the
general,
alien worlds in Interstellar, like the giant waves and stuff like,
sorry,
stuff like
yeah,
that.
Interstellar, that's definitely a better example.
But
in general, it's all very grounded, like contemporary, mm-hmm, you know, like it's not in the world of magic is generally Christopher Nolan's scope. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time he's applied that eye to, or not first time again, because of Interstellar and other stuff, but like one of the first times he's applied that eye to this kind of fantastical universe with these, like, with gigantic cyclops and other Greek gods and magical beings.
It's very much like, I was just rewatching Lord of the Rings, like Fellowship with my kids, and I was like, where is this? Why are we not doing this? It's been 25 years since we made these movies, and nobody's out there kicking ass, making big widescreen epics, traveling the world, fighting monsters or whatever, and this is it. This is like that upgrade I've been waiting for.
So I found that to be, in general, very compelling. Mm-hmm. When he's able to capture the stuff in camera, it looks and feels very, very real. There are some times when it's clearly CG and it doesn't look as good, and that is a little jarring. But overall, it's like, wow, it actually looks like they went and somehow figured out a way to physically do a lot of this stuff. I'm sure
the Cyclops stuff worked for me because it feels like, it doesn't feel like a CG model. It feels
sure,
like
it's not. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's some dude.
I'm sure everything was enhanced by visual effects, but I'm just saying a lot of the stuff felt real to me in a way that I think previous adaptations or similar depictions have not been able to hit. And so that's one of the big things that I think the movie was able to achieve. I had suspected that there would be some time-bending element to this movie because Christopher Nolan basically is pretty much physically incapable of telling a story linearly. And in fact, that isn't what happens in this case of the Odyssey. I think it's very smart. He essentially follows two separate storylines, right? There is Penelope and Telemachus at Odysseus's home trying to figure out what to do with all these suitors in the hall, and Telemachus is trying to find his father. And then in parallel, Odysseus is marooned on the island with Calypso and is trying to figure out a way to
Much older Odysseus.
Yeah, much older Odysseus. Older. Trying to figure out a way to get home. And then both storylines flash back to tell you kind of the story of how they got to this point. The first hour that Jeff is talking about, I can understand why someone would find it frustrating. It's basically messy. Doesn't involve Odysseus at all, virtually, right? Yeah.
On a beach, and it doesn't explain much of what's happening there. That whole scene with Elliot Page, like, it's beautiful. And then you're like, oh, that's the Trojan horse. What's it doing on the beach?
Right.
And we only get a full context for that
and
later.
Then we cut to Penelope and Telemachus, and we follow them for quite a period of time before we even get into the story. But to me, this actually was I liked the way that it approached that, because I got pretty invested in that storyline. Like, when you read about it in high school or grade school, it's like, oh yeah, all these people want to marry Penelope. That'll make sense. Like, what this movie does such a great job of is depicting how uncomfortable that situation would be for everyone.
It's
involved.
The worst house party. It is the worst. It is like, you have all these guests, they won't fucking leave, but because of Zeus's law, you got to take care of them. Like, it is about hospitality and how you take care of people, except then they start to take advantage of you. Yeah.
That's the strongest theme of the movie. And I love how it lands the plane at the end with the theme of Zeus's law. And I think it is commenting on the world today and the notion of grace and hospitality and treating your fellow human as you would be treated. I think that rings true by the end of the movie, and it really hammers that point home in a way that I appreciated. So I did like that. I just think it takes so long to rev up, and so much of the opening parts of the movie are Telemachus and Penelope just jawing at each other, and it's like, I don't know, I had a hard time getting into this.
I'm not surprised, Jeff, because like it wastes no time getting to scenes they had in the teasers and the trailers, where it's just like, this is the layup, right? Where the hell is Odysseus? It's been a very long time. Telemachus is like an adult now. He's a young man trying to find his father. They've been dealing with the suitor thing for a long time. I kind of like the way it sketches that base conflict, because that is ultimately the thing driving the entire story. Where is Odysseus? And then Odysseus is on this other island with Charlize Theron, and we don't know. They don't explain at all what he's
interesting.
Doing there until very long.
It felt to me like this massive info dump at the beginning of the movie. It did not feel like dramatizing that conflict. It felt like people explaining to me that conflict. And that's why I felt like it was just mired.
I think that goes back to the kind of spoken word aspect of this story, right? This is a story that was told. I love the way it begins in that way. There is an orator kind of starting to tell the story, and that is how the story was consumed by a lot of people. I hear you. I hear you. It's just like, for this, it's like it ties into like how we initially consume the story. I don't know. It just worked.
Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more conversation about the Odyssey right after this. But yeah, Jeff, I'm sorry that first part didn't work for you. It worked for me. This is like the first 45 minutes of Die Hard for me. You know, it's like, this is what we need to get actually invested in this story. You can imagine, like, and I actually think this is better than if they told it linearly. Like, if they told it linearly and we started with Odysseus and Troy, and then he went on his journey, and then we're cut to home, and they've been waiting for a while. It's like, oh wow, I think that would have just been much less effective. The way they did it, I'm like, oh, I get it. This is like a hard situation that Penelope and Telemachus are in, and we want them to like get out of it. We want to see how they extricate themselves from this.
I wish it worked for me. Believe me.
Fair enough. Okay. The other thing, you know, that Jeff, you alluded to in your opening about it was the language, and obviously it's a very deliberate choice. when, you know, Jeff, I know you don't follow the trailers, but when the first trailer came out or teaser came out and Tom Holland referred to Odysseus as dad, people freaked out. They're like,
this is terrible.
This looks like garbage. And Nolan wanted to modernize it. And there is a, it's reasonable for some people to feel like there's an incongruity between this, what I would say is very, very modern language.
It's
like,
they're using
terms like dad and mom and like
party. You
know, party, right? I heard the term party. I'm like, wow. So
Anne Hathaway is like, you guys gonna party in here? You just partying in here? And I'm like, whoa, okay.
Yeah,
whoa.
I know. And it's it honestly reminded me a little bit, not quite the same thing, but a little bit of Death of Stalin, right? Which is.
Sure.
So Death of Stalin is a movie by, I think, Armando Iannucci. And there was a question of, why didn't you have everyone speak in Russian accents? And first of all, that would be extremely distracting. But also, what he did do was have everyone speak in different English accents, right? Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that's not what we did here. We just made everybody speaking British accents, I would have been very upset.
Right.
But
right.
I'm talking more about the quality of the language, not about the...
Yeah, yeah. Sure. Well, I mean, the contention, right, is in favor of the film is people back then probably had informal terms to refer to their parents as, you know, and other informal terms. And so we're just seeing whatever the equivalent of that would be.
Whoever was orating this story to you, it is up to them how they told that story, right? This is a story that is, it's like Plato. It is flexible for the audience and adapted like who knows how many times over the centuries, over the millennia. I also want to point out, like Nolan was inspired by reading Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey, which itself got a lot of controversy because she modernized like how certain things were done. And there's a lot of like gross misogyny and stuff in there too. So I'm looking forward to reading her interpretation of it. But this is like Odyssey channeled down, modernized twofold over based on what older translations were from even like a decade or so ago.
But you have to acknowledge that he's modernizing the language, but not modernizing the setting in any way, right? We're still, he's
like there's an incongruity there, you know?
Yeah, between, I mean, we're still, like, you know, using, you know, he's very, very intentionally building this world in a historical setting and then kind of having people talk in a way that, as you say, seems incongruous to that setting.
Yeah.
It's like you kind of want, he wants to have it both ways. And for me, by the end of the movie, I had lost the annoyance about that. But like I said, it's a tough transition. Like the first 45 minutes to an hour of this movie, I was like, wow, this is not good. and it wins me over. It won me over by the sheer audacity of what you see, the sheer scale of what you see.
Right.
And there are moments, like there are sequences, I'm sure we'll talk about a number of them, but there are sequences when, especially in, you know, this massive IMAX theater that has IMAX sound, and the score is just assaulting you during some of these moments where it's just like, and you're just like, oh, I'm holding on for dear life in these moments. And it goes on and on and on. And people are doing things. It's like at a certain point, you're just like, I am inside this movie. You know? So there's no denying that where a part of me was like, is what I'm watching even that exciting, or is the score like doing 90% of the work here?
The score is rattling your bones. Yeah.
There's a fight scene. I remember there's a fight scene like toward the end where it's like, I don't necessarily think this is one of the great fight scenes ever filmed, but the score is telling me that it is. Like it is. And you're so wrapped up in the intensity of where the score is going. It's like, it doesn't even matter when I could be watching two toddlers poke each other in the eye and I'd be still be like, this is incredible.
I think that's part of like what works for me about this movie. It is very poetic in how it tells this story. So for the first hour, you were just like holding onto your armrest, trying to get a sense of like what is happening. But I actually think up front, it tells you a lot of stuff. And then it is very loosey-goosey about how it spends its time and what it focuses on. But you get to know these characters. And that it's that Nolan style. Like, I think people complained about it back in the Batman days too. Just like, oh, he's just here now. He's in a different setting. You don't like give us a location shot. Like, we don't understand the editing of how Batman is moving around. And here it's kind of like that too, but he's basically saying, keep up with what I'm doing here. And I also feel like this is a movie that feels like it will reward multiple viewings, because your second yes. time, you're not going to be like trying to figure it all out. You can actually enjoy those aspects of it. So I'm seeing it again in a couple days, and I was dreading it. I was like, if I don't like this movie, this would be torture for another 3 hours. But now I'm like, yes, give it to me now. Stick it in my veins.
Please. I do agree with that. I had that same sense of like, the first hour is going to land completely differently on the second viewing. The other thing I want to bring up real quick is, I don't think you can, from my perspective, I don't think you can minimize the fact that Christopher Nolan is in a unique position where every single actor on earth wants to work with him.
Yes.
And so this movie is chock-a-block with top tier talent. Like, a part that is like an under five, you know, you have Mia Goth, like, the star of other movies, in like an under five role in this movie.
You know, I'll play a house
under
servant.
Five, meaning under 5 minutes is what you're trying to say, right?
No, under five lines.
Under five lines. Okay, got it.
The smallest roles that you would never be able to get the star of other movies, like literally the above the line marquee star of other movies are playing roles that would be beneath them, theoretically.
That's right.
And so, like,
just to be a part of this crew, basically.
Well, and there is an effect, at least on me, and I suspect on a large swath of the audience, there's an effect that elevates that, where you literally see somebody just walking on. It's like, oh my God, that's a movie star.
Right.
And that's a movie star. And that's a movie star. And they're all like, they could all anchor their own films and have done.
Yeah.
But here it's this ensemble of all of the biggest stars on the planet, like in this world. And so there's something that kind of elevates the telling of this, where literally it is peopled by the biggest movie stars in the world right now.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's nothing like that.
That's how you tell an epic, right? Like, the biggest, you will recognize every face walking onto the screen. And even it's like, it is genuinely surprising. I heard that John Leguizamo was cast in this movie. I did not realize who he would be playing. It's like, oh man, this movie shows so much love to John Leguizamo, an actor I've loved growing up, and I feel like has not really had like great supporting roles recently. But this is, he plays, Eumaeus, the shepherd that is loyal to Odysseus. And it's just like, there is so much heart and pathos in that character. It's like, God damn, what made you think of John Leguizamo for this? Thank you. Thank you for even doing that. Like, there's some deep pulls here that I didn't really, didn't expect. Hemish Patel, who I've loved in everything, is like one of the dudes on the boat with Odysseus and like practically second in command, it seems. And just, I appreciate the casting.
I was so excited to see Lupita Nyong'o, you know, seeing her, she's just radiant and gorgeous. You know, oh yes, Helena Troy. She's like, four minutes of this
four
movie.
4 minutes of the movie.
Less than five lines.
Okay. Couple of other things I want to point out about like how this story was told. One of the things that I'm actually very sympathetic to your take on, Jeff, is I love the movie. I think it's amazing. In my opinion, it is top tier Nolan. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the specific sequences and how they're amazing. But I did have a couple of small issues with the film. It will not surprise you to learn. And one of them is that we basically speed run through all of Odysseus's adventures. Like, much time is spent setting up the Penelope Telemachus thing. And then literally the titular Odyssey is pretty much over by hour three. Right. It's so the whole last.
Listen to the sentence you just said. It's over by hour three.
Right? Yeah, yeah. No. But like,
I would hope so.
By the third hour, right? Uh-huh. Like the final hour is like basically with him back at home.
Yeah.
And so like the Odyssey itself, in my opinion, only lasts about an hour and a half, right? In the middle of this film, and And I think that
it's the greatest hits. It's the Cliff's Notes.
It feels like the Cliff's Notes were like fast forward.
Which is what I'm
like,
saying. You can't make it shorter. It's already the Cliff's Notes. Right,
but yeah, you can cut out the other stuff. You can shorten the other stuff.
Each one of these adventures is enough for a whole movie. Right?
100%.
Each one of these encounters is enough for a whole movie. And it often felt to me like we're just kind of speed running. Like we're not talking and hey, did you see the dead guy come out of the ground? Like we're not like talking and processing this incredible thing we just saw.
No, that just happened.
It feels very episodic. It feels
very
like,
episodic, but like, but not in a good, not in a good way. Not in a good way, in my
exactly.
opinion,
in a good way.
Yeah, and so like that's, I wish we had either cut some stuff out, as Jeff suggests, or had an additional hour to like really process like, a lot of this stuff.
We didn't tell Lord of the Rings in one movie because that would have been
absolutely.
A disaster.
I mean, this could have been like
there could have been three movies. It absolutely could have been three movies.
Or just two had been fine too. Yeah.
I wish he had taken the Dark Knight approach with this and made three movies out of it. That would have been great. Maybe he would have been able to get the money for it. But I do think like it does suffer from. Oh, and we're just on to the next. We're not even thinking about that thing, that incredible thing that just happened. We're just on to the next thing.
And he doesn't want to leave any of it out. He wants to cram it all in. And he wants to cram all in all the context too. So we have, you know, like this sort of shorthand explanation of Helen of Troy and all of the sort of backstory stuff. Mm-hmm. It feels so forced and dense. And it's like, well, but you elongated this section and condensed this section, and for me, both things didn't really work. I think for me, honestly, I think that points to pacing problems. Like it feels rushed here and overlong here, and it could have been massaged a little bit better at the script level or as you said, expanded into multiple movies so we don't have to feel that way.
I didn't feel it was too long there. I felt like the journey stuff was rushed. I did not feel the other stuff was too long at all. And but you know, a totally fair point. But I will say, like, despite how rushed some of that middle stuff felt, I never lost the emotional through line of the movie, which is this guy's trying to get home. His wife and his son are in a terrible position, and like they're literally in danger, right? And so like that tension held for me throughout the entire 3-hour movie. By the way, just data point.
Yeah, go ahead.
I went to see this movie with my brother. I said, "Hey, do you want to be my guest for the Odyssey?" And he has two very young children. And so he sees about, I want to say, 3 movies a year in theaters, right? So this is like a special thing for him to come see a movie. And we were sitting there before the movie began. And he's like, "How long is this movie?" And I said, "It's 3 hours long." And he said, "Oh, yeah. I went to see Oppenheimer. That was 3 hours long as well." That felt like 3 hours.
Yes.
You know, I'm curious if this will feel like 3 hours. We get out of the movie. He says, "It didn't feel like 3 hours." That's just random, you know, take from another person as to what they thought. But okay, so those are like some of the big decisions I felt this movie made, right? Modernizing the language, changing the chronology, like in terms of how you're showing it on screen. Also, by the way, one thing the movie does as well I think it's a pretty big choice, but like, you know, we don't need to discuss how impactful this was, is other than Athena, it basically removes all the gods from the movie. Like there's no gods that are like scheming.
You feel the influence of the
Poseidon
gods, but they're not
Zeus
walking around.
Right. Like, and by the way, Athena, maybe she's not even there, right? Like you know, who knows? So it's like a kind of very grounded, no gods version of the Odyssey, which
no gods, but also clearly the gods are angry, right?
Well,
this is how humans interpreted the world back then. It's like, oh, my journey is bad. I guess I got to blood sacrifice my daughter to have, you know, to help me on this battle or something. That is how the world worked. And it was, I don't know. It kind of gives us a glimpse into that. Yeah.
Pretty big god moment with Cersei, though, right?
Isn't
Cersei a god?
She's a goddess. I guess that's
That Samantha Morton scene is one of the best scenes in the entire movie.
Yeah, so let's talk about let's go through some of the big sequences of the film, right? So we've already spent time talking about the first hour.
Say, by the way, though, like the intro, I love a good opening shot, right? And the intro where they get to Elliot Page on the beach. It starts with the dinner sequence, the hammering,
Yeah.
This is the story beginning. That is a baller way to just get you into the.
Well, and then no. Devendra, let's go even further back. Let's go further back.
Let's go.
To the Universal logo.
Yes.
No, I'm 100% serious.
Yes. Right?
The Universal logo comes on screen, but it is not planet Earth in modern day. Mm-hmm, it is Earth as it was back at the time that the story was told.
My favorite thing.
There are no electric lights. Like, it's just lightning storms. I was like, that is awesome. I love that. That's cool. That's like one of my favorite ones of these like movie logo alterations.
It gets you. It's like, oh, you're cool. in for something different here. And then it's not music getting you in. It is hammering.
Well, and then the text appears on screen. I don't remember what the text said. It was like something like,
this is a time of magic.
Yeah, it was a time of magic or something.
No, it was a time of, there's an adjective before it. A time of, evident magic or something like that. Like it's like a qualifier that's like it's a time of
apparent magic.
Yeah,
interesting, right?
It's like the gods may be influencing
the god. Yeah, the gods may be influencing, or maybe they're not, right? And the movie.
Yeah,
I mean, yes, there's the goddess of Cersei and also the big sea monster that comes out of the cliff and all the other stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty big. Yeah,
and the huge. It's pretty apparent. Okay, so then Devendra. Then we get to this like the song and the hammering on the thing.
This is how we start a story, is by this. This is the orator making you pay attention. That's what the movie does. Then, no context scene on the beach. Elliot Page.
Right.
Looking incredibly buff, by the way. Immediately killed. And I was like, what are you doing in this movie? It's like, I just was so happy to see Elliot Page. And now it's just brutally, brutally killed. People were jumping out of their seats when that happened because the arrow shots are so loud and so brutal.
Yeah.
And then you don't fully know what's going on there. Keep going. Scene by scene.
It is quick. Did it seem weird to you guys how people shoot arrows in this movie?
Yeah.
It's casual the way they shoot arrows in this movie. Right.
I think Matt Damon had to do a lot of training for it. So like he looks like somebody who's done it quite a bit. Talk about flexes. Right. The way he flexes that bow. How much did he train? Sick. You see his arm muscles. You see his chest muscles. Like he had to train.
Dude's 50 something really too. Yeah.
I mean, incredible. I have to say that one of the most effective moments of the moment, you know, we watch movies and sometimes there are moments that make us feel like we have transcended. Like, oh, wow, I'm experiencing pure cinema distilled into its essence. Early on in the film, they introduce Matt Damon and he likes to pluck the, first of all, he needs to string the bow.
Thwong.
And he got buff enough to convince you that he can do that, which is cool, right?
Yeah. That's why you take this role, by the way, is you work out for several years to get that body. Just this is
grow
my last
beard,
chance to
work
do
on
this.
The muscles.
And he has
work
a thing where he says like, I like to like pluck the bowstring before I shoot the animal because like that's
give
the
him
most
fair chance.
That's the most honorable. Yeah. And you see him do it throughout the film. And then the final time he does it, the score like crescendos and it matches the note that he hits.
It goes dong 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 dong.
It leads up to it. And it's like when he plucked it. And I was like, oh my God. I'm like crying in my mind. That is amazing.
People were jumping up and clapping.
Yeah, it is so
funny. And he's about to just lay the hammer down on some fools too, so you feel it.
That was also it's just like, oh, this is so, how did they make this so badass? Like this is a text that's thousands of years old. They made it so badass.
And then that's the moment where the score just decides to go.
But yeah, basically like the bowstring and the note that it plays is the climactic moment of the score, is basically what I'm trying to communicate. And it's incredible.
It's
the experience
cool.
of the theater.
All those little things. There's so many little things like that. But let's go scene by scene because I'll bring up
that. Okay, but before we do that, let's take a break for sponsor. We'll be back with more of The Odyssey right after this. Okay, so let's talk about some of the other big sequences. I don't have a scene by scene breakdown, but let's just talk about the big sequences, right? So there is the Cyclops scene. Now,
let's talk about the opening first, because I think it does do a good job of setting up Penelope as not somebody who is just like sitting and waiting, right? She is actively working to prolong this whole suitor thing. Like she is an active agent in the story. I appreciate that. Let's talk about Robert Pattinson, who has put on the best shit heel face. Like you just want to, every word that guy says, every look he gives, like, I just want to punch that guy in the face. Tremendous performance.
It is a tremendous performance because, he is incredibly hateable.
There is, if you had never heard of Robert Pattinson and you watched this movie,
right,
no one would be able to convince you he's ever been the romantic lead in anything. Like, you would never believe that right. he's ever been the hero of a movie. You're like, there's no way, because that guy is a shitbird. Like, right. there's no way yeah. anyone would ever root for him. Yeah.
He was a superhero in a film that made $800 million worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, there's literally a moment where Batman and Spider-Man are facing off against each other in this
Amazing.
Movie.
Amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Catwoman's watching.
But he is this sniveling... undignified, hateable character yeah. that has...
From the beginning. From he the doesn't beginning. Even build up to that. From the beginning, he's yeah. a little shit. And yeah. I kind of appreciate that sometimes. Sometimes you need a villain you just hate.
You appreciate yeah. his ability to really inhabit this role. He's also going to play Chris Hansen later this year in a documentary, or sorry, not a documentary, a movie about To Catch a Predator. So very curious mm-hmm. how much of this energy he's going to bring to that role. Okay, so shall we get to the set pieces, Devendra? Anything else
yes.
you want to talk about?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so... So the big set piece is, right, the Cyclops. Now, I have
played
to
by
say,
Bill Irwin, by the way. Bill Irwin motion capturing the Cyclops. I love that
yeah,
man.
He's
so
Mr.
Much.
Motion Capture.
Yeah.
I have to say, the way the Cyclops was depicted worked for me, it just mm-hmm. physically, like how it looked and sounded. But I have to say, I'm not really sure about this version of Odysseus that we get in this scene. Mm-hmm. Because...
Goddamn
he comes
idiot.
Off as kind of a moron, right? Yes. Where he's like, we're just charging in here. Now.
He's okay, not a
I'm gonna shoot
hero.
Him one more time, yeah. guys.
Now.
Yeah.
Now, I did think to myself, hey, he just pulled off this whole Trojan horse thing. So maybe he's like really cocky coming off
They were
of
on that.
That
beach for 10 years.
Right.
And, it was and, his and, idea that won this. Yeah.
And he's cocky coming off of that. But then literally that thought I just described is mm-hmm. undermined by the end of the film, right? Because... the end of the film, you find out what his real mental state was
yeah.
at that time. And it's not, hey, I'm a badass triumphant guy. So no. I just don't like this version of Odysseus that we get at the beginning of this film.
This is Odysseus, though. Like, he is not a perfect hero. He is somebody dealing with his flaws. Like, the entire story is about him and his guilt. Even if you don't look at the interpretation of this movie, it is that. He is an imperfect hero. He's definitely built up as a hero, but he makes bad choices. He makes bad moves. This movie doesn't even get into this, but he has a child with Cersei, technically. We don't touch on that at all here. But he spends some time there and he has a child with her. And like, he is a guy making bad decisions. He's not always faithful to his wife. He's not always faithful to his men. That specific scene feels like, hey, here's some cheese. Let's take some cheese.
Yeah.
And Himesh Patel's character is like, maybe not. Maybe we should go. This is a big, scary cave. Maybe we should leave. I like that whole sequence because you have no idea what's going on. They're like, what the hell is this? It's a giant with one eye. They don't know what's going on. They don't know how to communicate. But that thing, it's the first time you see the impossible in this movie. And I like how tiny and how puny the human seemed against, against this giant Cyclops.
Yeah, just like the way that the light is let into the cave. By the way, one of the things we mm-hmm. haven't mentioned is the film seems to be shot in almost completely all natural lighting, which mm-hmm. I have to say is really impressive. Like, there's scenes
and also
that
the first film fully shot in IMAX too. By the way, that's why I'm right. going to see it. So,
and
yeah,
I don't know this to be true. It may not be, but it certainly looks a lot like the actors are not heavily makeuped.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so it's sometimes unflatteringly so. Right?
Exactly.
And so,
yeah.
I think, and it leads to like some really challenging technical situations where, hey, we want to depict a whole army rushing into this city at night, but it's night. And so everything needs to be illuminated by torchlight, basically. And
yeah.
But also he uses that to some really badass effect.
The movie is very dark.
It's very dark.
Very dark.
It's a very dark movie.
Yes.
Overall. So anyway, I really enjoyed some of the sequences from some of the moments from the Cyclops thing. Again, not loving the characterization of Odysseus, but when I say loving the characterization of Odysseus, I mean it doesn't feel consistent to me with what the film has described him as. But the part when they're all like have the straw on their mm-hmm. back and they're, you know, crawling out and the Cyclops is like touching them.
Yeah. I love all the attempts by it. Let's just run. Nope. Doesn't work.
I killed a couple dudes.
That didn't work. A couple guys died there. Let's poke him in the eye. Okay. Okay. That's at least a step, you know. It is his flaws. It's his flaws as a hero that makes him an interesting character because, leaving, they're like, what are you doing? Don't shoot him again. You know, and Himesh Patel is like, don't, let's just go. We're good. We're good here. And he loses more men because of this, right? He basically pokes the gods in the eye even more.
Yeah. There is the scene of them then going into, but by the way, like, I love that at the beginning of the film, or towards the beginning of the film, they're like, Agamemnon's taking like the regular supply route. And he's like, oh, it's okay. We can just take the other. And it's like, oh, wow. If he'd just taken that route, they'd have been home in no time. It would have been fine. So that one decision, very faithful.
By the way, Benny Safdie playing Agamemnon.
I just saw that.
You would never know in a million years. It could have been anybody.
It's interesting the way they chose not to show his face for pretty much the whole film. You see like glimpses of it, but
I feel like if you're hiding a face like that, it has to be a more, I don't know, a more like a bigger actor at that point. It's like Edward Norton in Kingdom of Heaven, right?
He's like Tom Hanks or something.
Yeah. a bigger surprise.
Tom Hanks
the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't remember what comes next exactly, but they do end up on the island of, those gigantic knights?
Centurion dudes.
What do you want to call them, right?
Love it. Again, like, I love the setup for that, too. It's like little girl just laughing at them, then leading to this whole thing. That sequence is amazing.
I mean,
and it feels very like Lord of the Rings, too. Yeah.
An hour and a half into the movie by that point. But it's an incredible sequence. And it's another one where in any other movie, those dudes are all CG. And you know, it's a big CG action sequence, and here it's doesn't seem to be. I don't know how they did it exactly to have those guys be that huge in comparison, but it certainly doesn't seem to be,
CG creations. They don't seem like all CG creations.
Yeah,
they are the Lestrigonians. Lestrigonians is who they are. Typically, they don't make it into these adaptations, but they're here and they're terrifying. Also, the way the forest seemingly moves around them is like, wow, how did they achieve that? That's
they made
cool.
Like little cages
picking up and flinging dudes, pretty
flinging
cool
dudes, and then it, like the dude breaks the tree in half. It's incredible.
I love how all these sequences are basically Odysseus and his men being like, this is messed up, run away, run away every
what
time
are
run
run
away
from next? Hey, is there food here? Shit.
Run away. Run away. It's like Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And then they get reduced down to one ship. And the way in which that happens is extremely brutal, like
And incredibly visualized. I mean, the what are they called? Lilliputians? What are they called?
Lestrigonians.
The Lestrigonians are
the like opposite,
just hacking away at the ships and then just physically tipping them over. Amazing,
brutal. And
you come to
and
my forest.
They cannot be. Yeah. They cannot be reasoned with at all. Like they just
they don't try talking either. Yeah. I like that bit with the Cyclops where they're like, oh, he's talking. He's calling for Poseidon. We didn't really try. We're probably past conversation, right? Probably past reasoning with it at this point.
Yeah,
maybe you could have started there. Yeah,
Here's one of the things that the modernizing does do is it lets there be a lot of humor in this film, which I think they're actually
I don't know about a lot of humor.
By Christopher Nolan standards, you know,
by Christopher Nolan standards,
there's a lot
the
more humor than there was
this.
In Oppenheimer, in my opinion. You know, so
anyway.
Tenet was a laugh riot. You know,
So they arrive at Circe's island.
Love it,
dude. This might be my favorite section of the entire movie. I think it's the section that establishes and maintains tension in the coolest way. And again, the score is doing a ton of work here because there's the score is like amped up during all this sequence. And it was during the boat moment we were just talking about. But, having the crew be like, no, you're the one who stays behind. He's like, is this a mutiny? And he's like, that's up to you. Great line.
I misinterpret. Yeah, that was a great moment. I actually misinterpreted it. I thought they were going to leave Odysseus on the island, and then they were going to leave. They're like, we think you should stay here, and we're going to go. So I misinterpreted that. But in general, Christopher Nolan shoots medium angle lenses, right? Medium angle, not very much shallow depth of field. But he really pulled out the shallow depth of field for this Cersei sequence when she's shaping their heads to be
animals. Even before we get there, like leading up to it, I love the buildup. The buildup in this movie is always good. You're walking up. What the hell is a tiger doing? What the hell is a lion doing here? And they're just chilling. Like the guys are like, are these red flags? I don't know. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep going. Yeah.
It's amazing what hunger will do.
Oh, crazy witch lady is offering us food. Sure, why not?
Well, the biggest thing is when she says, take off your armor, and there's already tons of armor outside.
It's and they're like,
what are you doing, guys?
That's probably fine.
I'm sure that's fine. She just loves armor.
She just loves it. No red flags there. Again, men, you deserve this. You deserve this, whatever came to you.
This is probably the closest that Christopher Nolan has ever come to directing a horror sequence. I think.
Yeah.
Like just the way she shapes the heads. And I love
the eating. Yeah.
The eating. And
I
want
to know what
eating.
The direction was. Like, I want you guys to eat in the most horrific, you know, I want you to
you
eat in a way that will make me want to throw up when I watch.
Yeah, you cannot stop eating no matter what. Like, you are compelled to continue eating.
It also, it reminds me of Spirited Away quite a bit too. I feel like some echoes of these mythologies, you know, last in our societies, and it's the same thing in Spirited Away. Like a ravenous eating, like pigs, and it turns you into pigs.
Yeah. But then Odysseus is able to talk his men out of it, and they get out of there.
Let's come on. Come on, let's do this. Odysseus is out there fighting, like trying to shoot a deer, doing the pluck, doing the thing. I love the reveal. He walk up, naked dude.
And like, you kind of know what it's going to be when you get there, but it's a great reveal.
By this point, the men have already been transformed. So you know something weird is happening. He reveals it. He runs up. I love the conversation, him just walking in, and you can see the pigs are just like, watch out. Watch out. The pigs are like heightened, like trying to stop him a little bit too.
Yeah,
and he is trying to outsmart her. All these little elements, I think, really add to the texture of this movie. Like, it is really thoughtful in terms of how it portrays these sequences, even if it's like a little confusing at first.
Well, did one of you mention that Odysseus technically has a child with Cersei?
In the story, he does.
Yeah. I do think that this movie really whitewashes Odysseus in many ways, right? Like, he doesn't have this kid with Cersei. Calypso, they are, my understanding is, they know each other biblically in, you know, in
I think
the
it's
story.
Pretty, you're on an island with Charlize Theron for 7 years.
Yeah.
She's a nymph.
But they don't like depict that. They don't even like really hint at that at all.
Do we want another Christopher Nolan sex scene? Do you remember what happened last time?
No, I don't think you need a sex scene.
You don't need a sex scene, but
the notion that he's loyal to his wife through this entire period is implied heavily.
Yeah. That's right. And that is not the case with the original story.
Right.
And I am curious, like, why? I guess they, maybe Nolan thought that that would make him more relatable or more easy to root for. Right.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a little puritanical. Yeah. Like, a lot puritanical, honestly. But I guess the movie does not really show that they have had sex, but also I don't know what the implication there is too, because he's under the effect of the lotus leaves, right? He's not fully himself. So if he did do that, they're on a break.
They do show
they're on a break. It's totally
baby,
fine.
Baby, we're on a break.
My mind was clouded by the lotus
we're
leaves.
On a break. I was inside a horse. I was inside a lady. What are you going to do?
I was mouthful of lotus leaves. I don't know what
is that what they're calling them? So there is a moment when she describes him falling in love, and then you see them
she
holding
loves
hands.
Him.
You see them
she
holding
him,
hands.
They're holding hands.
Yeah, she loves him. Yeah. But like, in my opinion, it is at very least only mildly implied that they might have slept with each other. And I think
what else are they going to do?
What else are they
shows
do?
Them no other activities available.
Well,
to them.
He was stuck for 10 years on that beach with just dudes. I think my man's a little thirsty. Yeah.
What's interesting too is I believe in the original story, right? Calypso's island, Ogygia, is like a verdant, like beautiful, lush place. Yeah. It's interesting that he chose to depict it as a desert in this one. I guess it's worth pointing out just because obviously he's sanding some of the edges, some of the shaggy elements off of the story.
And this is a true love story.
More of a simple, tale, as opposed to
yes.
Odysseus yeah. fucked this person and he had sex with this person, you know, like, and no, then it like I complicates it, right?
It seems mm-hmm. to be very important to him that Penelope and Odysseus's love is
right.
pure.
Pure, right.
Yes. And
untainted.
That's right. And they would wait for each other as long as it took and all right. that stuff. And, you know, yeah. I think that does change things significantly.
It does change
from
it.
The source
sure.
material.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And you can decide whether you appreciate that change from the like, you know,
he's not just holding hands with Calypso. Sorry, I'm sorry. Like, yeah.
You think
what
the
else
movie implies
doing?
That? I don't think so.
I don't
so.
Think
I think
the movie
implies that.
I don't think
the
movie implies that.
I agree.
Time.
There yeah. is no, and the movie does have an implication of sex when earlier on Penelope yeah. and yeah. Odysseus have sex. So it's not. Yeah. It's not yeah. like the movie doesn't know how to depict that kind of stuff. I would say it is at the very
barely.
Best.
I feel like Nolan learned his lessons. Like, oh, I'm starting a sex scene. Cut away. That's cut right. away before yeah. it gets
that's
really
right.
awkward.
But Devendra, he didn't do yeah. that with Calypso. So I
it's
think
true. You're
at the very
right.
least,
you are
it's,
right.
it's
you are
big,
right.
in my opinion.
But again, right. in my headcanon, buddy, what are you doing right. there? You're there for 7 years. I don't.
That's fine.
What else are we going to do? Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about the thing of Menelaus, the Greek king of Sparta, played by John Barenthal. So this
lovely.
Is one of the stops that Telemachus makes on the way to the priests. And Jeff, you seem to think this whole section was completely unnecessary. I mean, it was primarily an info dump, I would say. It was
yes.
primarily an exposition dump, right?
Of and like, this is our only glimpse of Helen of Troy, too. So the scene right. is kind of necessary to, like, this is why all this happened.
Right.
Somebody kidnapped yeah, her. This whole thing, yeah.
It doesn't, yeah. it doesn't, I don't think it's additive for the, in the context of this film. I don't think mm-hmm. it's necessary. And in a movie that's this long and, it, you know, sort of shorthands other things, this is one of the things that I would have mm-hmm. excised.
I love those conversations though, because otherwise, what the hell does Telemachus do? He's like a little whiny boy. It's like, make me king, mommy. This is an active thing he does. He's like, okay, I'm going to figure out what the hell happened to my dad. You're stuck here, mm-hmm. like with the suitor. It's fine.
Right.
I'm going to go do something. So it feels like at the very least, he is an active agent in this story. And John Bernthal, they don't really say Spartans too loudly, but come on, who are you going to make the king of the Spartans in this day and age? Gerard Butler has kind of aged out of it. So you've got John Bernthal right there. I love those conversations because it conveys the sort of respect he had for Odysseus, the way they welcome Telemachus in, but also the really gross way he treats Helen is just like, it tells you a lot about this story. Lupita Nyong'o does not get many chances to speak in this movie, but she is there as a presence, and the way he like physically turns her head, I was like, oh, that's gross. That is gross, but that is the driving force. It is men and the ownership they have of women that caused all of this, really. Like, we never see, she was supposed to escape to Troy with Paris. We never see Paris. We never see the instigating moment of this entire story.
Right.
But we get a glimpse of Helen. So that's why I think Bernthal just like added a great amount of like pathos to the story. And he is a father figure to Telemachus, who doesn't really have one at this point, because he is surrounded by dudes who want to kill him. This is one dude who's like, hey, I'm going to be real with you, buddy. This is one way you could survive, is to figure out a way with the suitors. This gives him the plan of one way they can deal with them, basically.
Yeah, and why don't we just finish off the Telemachus plotline now and talk about mm-hmm. like the scene with the temple. I actually really enjoyed, right, when he finally gets to the temple and Odysseus is there and warns him, hey, these guys are here to kill you, and then Odysseus starts killing everyone, and I thought that was pretty cool sequence. Enjoyed that one.
We really have to interrogate like why Matt Damon loves to play this guy, right? The guy who has to, he's fighting his way back home, potentially lost his memory. He has made this movie so many times, and once again he's here, secret badass. It turns out am I a Becker? No, I'm a secret badass.
Oh my god, it's Jason Bourne.
Basically. Oh my God. It's
Jason Bourne, right?
It's Odysseus.
I had a thought, and you guys are going to hate this, but I was like, can you imagine this movie if Odysseus is played by Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
Shut up. Shut up, Jeff. Don't ruin a movie for me.
That would have been interesting.
I think that'd be kind of badass.
I think it would have been in some ways more plausible that he's the only one that can string that bow.
Yes,
you know?
And he's like,
perhaps, yeah.
The Rock
yeah.
is getting to the right age where he's kind of like, you'd see him as this aging warrior in a
right.
way that Matt Damon just isn't. I think Matt Damon's great in the movie. Yeah. No doubt about it.
The Rock has no range, man. I'm sorry. I'm gonna tear down this idea immediately, but I'm sorry. Like, the crucial work of this movie is not the badassery. It is him being vulnerable, being like, what the hell have I done? It is him dealing with the guilt. It is him dealing with the fact that I need to get back to my family somehow, and trying to like interrogate that, and also the guilt of like being away from them for so long. This is such a nuanced role. I agree that it is kind of unbelievable that Matt Damon's the only one that can string that bow. That is true, because that seems like it takes pure muscle strength.
A couple of other sequences I want to mention. There is the sirens, and I thought that was pretty great sequence. That's going to be on Matt Damon's best actor Oscar reel right there. Was
losing his shit.
Screaming in agony. I will say the setup was a little strange, where I believe in the book, if I recall correctly, the reason he doesn't get earwax in his ears is so he can continue to command the men.
Yeah.
And instead, this one, it just feels like,
he's like, I want to feel it, baby.
I just want to feel something. I just want to, like,
curious what those sirens sound like?
Yeah, no one has ever heard the sirens and survived. He's like, that's why I'm going to be the first.
Yeah.
It's this very kind of.
Here we go.
I can
withstand anything. But even before that, like his brief glimpse into hell. I love that whole sequence too. Yeah,
the way Hades is depicted in the movie is pretty spectacular.
Incredible. It's on the black sand beach.
Incredible. And then the way they're all blackened and besooted.
Right.
It is.
And the guys coming out of the ground and just, I mean, basically any scene where you have like 50 of these dudes on a beach somewhere, it's like, wow, it took enormous logistical expertise to even make that happen.
The dragging
that happens
like
a dozen
Trojan
times during the course of this movie.
A dozen times, but the dragging the Trojan horse, I keep looking back at that, seems like, did they just do that?
I think we skipped over the sacking of Troy.
Theoretically it happens at the end of the movie. You know, that's the big
one. But
we could talk about the actual Trojan horse stuff, though.
I want to talk about that because
that is wild.
I think it's a bold, interesting version of the Trojan horse mythology. And certainly the interior of the Trojan horse, it's like unbelievable and just gut-wrenching sequence that is, you'd never think of it that way.
Right.
But then you're like, oh, of course it would be like that.
I've imagined this. I've read about this for so long, Jeff. And I was like, how would that work? How would you really stuff a bunch of dudes in that and not seem like totally believable?
Yeah,
this, it's so brutal.
Awful. Like the flooding of it and the straw, that was crazy. But I'm thumbs up for all of that imagery and thumbs up for how that all worked. That said, and you guys can correct me if I'm off base here because it's been a heck of a long time since I've read The Odyssey. But I feel like the fact that they just completely remove the notion that the Trojan horse is a gift undermines the whole Zeus's law theme.
That is not removed from the film.
No, it's there. They say it's a gift.
They say it's a gift.
Okay. Yeah. But
Elliot Page at the beginning is like, this
it's
is
just this thing they find on the beach.
No. The idea is that they have fled the beach. Yes. And they have left the gift behind as
with
like,
Elliot Page.
With Elliot Page, this is a peace offering. The war is over. We're convincing you that the war is over. Yes. This is a peace offering. Please
he says it's a
it.
Gift, basically.
So that is in
Do
the
Do you think
that,
that that's how that lands in the movie? I mean,
that's how it landed for me, but
That's how it landed for me. I agree. It is a little, again, it's a little elliptical. It's a little wonky because this is Nolan. But it is like, I think they looked at it and was like, oh, it's a beautiful sculpture. I think we can interrogate how they built that thing. From the remnants of the ship that they had.
I know, right?
Good work, boys.
But Jeff, I think you're saying there are many ways in which this deviates from our classical conception of this story, right? We have seen depictions where it's on wheels, first of all. That's a huge difference.
Yeah.
They wheel it up to the front and they're like, here you go.
We have a gift for you.
Here you go. Right.
The movie is so obsessed with this notion of
Zeus's law
and grace and giving the gift and all that stuff. I feel like having it feel like a piece of salvage, even if it's explicitly, was a gift at one point. They come up, they kill Elliot Page. They take it as this kind of piece of salvage. It doesn't feel to me like the classical notion of what the Trojan horse is, which is I got you to take my gift kind of deal. It just feels like it undermines that notion in stylistically.
I think, like, realistically, I don't. How would they get it there, right? To do the old way of doing it, put wheels on it and, like, bring it up to the gates or something, they'd probably be killed instantly. I get it. I see what you're saying. I just love the sort of, like, verisimilitude they took of portraying, like, how you would actually do the Trojan horse thing, where the camera's in there as they're, like, moving it, as they're dragging it, as they pull it upright. One of my favorite moments in this movie. The guy goes up and is like, okay, is this thing full? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, are there people in here?
Sword in. Are people in here? Stabs the guy. They muffle his screams. And somebody wipes the sword.
Amazing.
Yes.
Incredible.
Cleans the blood. Because the soldier looks at the blood, looks at the sword. He's like, oh, all right.
No blood.
We're all good here.
Okay.
No blood.
Good.
All good here. It's yeah, such a quick moment. You could easily miss it. But it's like,
it's a brilliant touch. It's a very similar
moment to The Raid Redemption, by the way. Extremely similar moment happens in that film. Which is where I'm sure Christopher Nolan got it, by the way. I'm just going to put that out there. But yes, it does have this kind of extreme verisimilitude. Guys, I discovered I do not want to be at the bottom of the Trojan horse.
Don't want to,
like,
be there.
Being
you
the
never
final
want to be.
Segment of a human centipede. You know, don't you do not want to be.
You want to be the. You don't want to be the horse's ass. That's what you don't want to be.
Well, but you either drown at high tide or you're covered in shit and piss.
They had to draw straws to be like, who's going at the bottom? Who's going to the bottom of the horse?
The other thing that's really cool about how that all is depicted is that, you know, the very beginning of the movie, you see Elliot Page get murdered. You know, right, stabbed into the horse.
Right.
And then later on, you see Odysseus's view of that
inside. And it's the same dialogue.
Same muffled dialogue. Yeah. And then the sword pops through. It's like, it's so cool.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm like, that is classic Christopher Nolan shit right there. You know?
Yeah.
I actually got super confused. I was like, because earlier on in the film, there's like a traveler that comes in. That's not Odysseus, though, is it?
No, that is a traveler.
That's a different dude. And I was like, wait, is that guy Odysseus from the, you know, I thought like Christopher Nolan was pulling, like, the twist is that was Odysseus the whole time. but I don't think it was. That doesn't make sense. Anyway, okay. Fast forwarding to the end, right? The final hour of the film, 45 minutes of the film, is basically Odysseus returns home and needs to figure out what to do in that situation. I love that Agamemnon seeded it in, right? Where he says, hey, FYI, maybe when you go home, like, assess the situation first.
Don't make my mistake.
Which I love. I love that, you know, he's careful about it. And
but the way they set that up, too, it's like he's welcomed home, but also we remember that glimpse. He sacrificed his daughter. Somebody's probably mad about that. Somebody. Probably his wife.
And here's where I sympathize with Jeff a little bit, where it's like, that stuff was really sped through. Like,
it's sped through.
Where it's like, his daughter is shown for like less than 10 seconds, right? And so we need to then, oh, he had a daughter? Oh, he sacrificed her? Oh, his wife was mad about it? Like, okay, I guess, you know. Like,
he's so committed that he sacrificed his daughter, too.
Sure.
Like, that tells you about that character before you even see his face.
He's basically not a character, though, in this film.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I
agree. That's the problem that I have.
And there's
that.
a number of those.
Yeah, there's a number of those. Yep. But again, the main through line of Odysseus needs to get home to his kid, you know, it still worked for me. He gets home to his kid. I was deeply moved when his son sees him for the first time. Like, the dog, which is like, that is a reference to the thing from the text of the dog. Right. And the dog recognizes him. And then that's when Telemachus knows, like, oh, that's dad. And they have this meeting in front of the house. And it's like where his son sees him for the very first time. It's beautiful. That's probably the emotional highlight of the movie for me, other than maybe the plucking of the bow.
It is funny though. Like, I couldn't help but have the thought. He walks up to the dog and he pets it, and the dog passes away. And I expected Tom Holland to come up and be like, "Did you just kill my dad's dog?"
Yeah, that would have been less impactful. But then he goes in and he's treated very badly by all the suitors, and then he has the conversation with Penelope. Right, where he kind of recounts everything that happened, and that's when we get to the emotional climax of the movie, which is that the reason he didn't want to come home is because war had changed him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, being away from home had changed him. And I have to confess that when I've read the story of Odysseus, like, I've never really focused on any of these elements before. It's always, when I've read in like high school or whatever, middle school, it's always been, hey, a guy goes on these wacky adventures and then he gets home, right?
Yeah.
But it never occurred to me that there was a part of him that didn't want to go home. I don't know like to what degree that's an addition from
the sacking of Troy. Like there are so many stories about the sacking of Troy and the fact that that is the climax of this movie. It's like, oh, we're the baddies.
We murdered
everybody in this Zeus's town. Law, we have violated Zeus's law by bringing a gift and, you know, violating that, but also murdering everybody in the city. I allowed my men to do this. Cersei kind of has like a bit of that too. Like your men, you just let them here. You know what they can do, but you let them to my house or let them come to my house. And I'm just a woman here all alone. It is that guilt like that he is dealing with because he fought for a king. He fought a war because somebody kidnapped somebody's wife. And was it worth the loss? Like the time he took away from his wife, from all the people that died, all the men that died. This is a movie where Odysseus is reckoning with like all the damage he's done to the world. I found that genuinely moving. I did not think the movie would actually go there.
I think the most beautiful element of it is the Zendaya of it all, where you know he has been seeing
Zendaya.
Been seeing Athena in this way, the goddess in his vision, you know, his vision of her, no one else sees her. And we realize he's been, you know, imagining her as this young girl that he saw murdered.
Yeah.
And I think that is the beautiful twist, if you want to call
that. That's right. Was Zendaya really there the whole time? Or was it, you know, or was Athena really there the whole time?
The idea is that, you know, whatever he communes with the goddess, he is, you know, he is personifying her in his vision as this.
That's right.
This element of his guilt.
That's right.
And I think that's a beautifully communicated in the movie.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. But I think this take on the film also just makes it extremely relevant to our current times, you know, like the moment we're living in of these are a people that forgot goodness, that forgot Zeus's law, that like horrifically violated Zeus's law in the most upsetting way imaginable. And how can you come back from that, right? How, like, maybe you don't want to go back to where you were because you're afraid of what the implications of that are. And I just found that to be just shockingly shockingly relevant for the moment that we're living through of like a people that have forgotten goodness. Right. And
goodness. And you know, Zeus's law, God's law, any religion's law is the golden rule, right? It's treat others how you would choose to be treated. And it does seem to be the case that the people who most venerate, you know, God often forget that simple truth. And it certainly seems to be the case in modern times. Mm-hmm. And I think the movie makes a beautiful case for that. And it is heart-wrenching at the end to realize that's where we've been heading this whole time is we've just forgot the simple basic truth that is, you know, the most important part of
life.
Be kind, the
realization that they are the people from the sea too, I think kind of really hammers all that home to like, you were the ones we've been warned about that would basically destroy our society. And
we'll do it to
ourselves. A lot of, it feels like, again, echoes of what we would eventually see in Lord of the Rings, right? Like this age of society is dying and maybe it'll come back, but based on what we've done, like we are practically the ones ending our civilization right now.
So then they do the bow and arrow thing, which is very amusing, and stringing the bow. And then when he finally strings the bow, it's totally badass. I love that. Mm-hmm. Didn't super love the action scene that came after it, I have to say. Mm-hmm.
It's not great. But
my brother's reaction was, wow, he really didn't have a plan for that.
Often he is the one holding the IMAX camera and like trying to follow things, but it feels messy. It feels messier than you expect.
But not even the filming of it, which I agree with you, Devendra, is messy, but it's
Odysseus
like,
didn't have
literally
a plan.
Odysseus is like, I'm just going to go at him.
I'm going to start shooting dudes and we'll see how he goes.
Dudes and cutting, and you know, maybe this, it's all going to work out.
This is where the phrase, I'm not trapped in here with you, trapped in here with me came from.
Yeah,
I love that dude. Like, literally, like, I'm gonna go to the ceiling and just pound a hole through the floor,
right? And just like start dropping.
I'm just gonna
shit.
Give my friends some weapons.
Yeah, and Antinous is behind a pillar. Get him! Get the spears!
Right. I like Antinous like just being a sort of weakling
coward
coward, right? And telling everyone to like that. I like that they gave Telemachus something to do during the scene because he can't hurt anyone or else he'll be exiled. I don't know who's actually keeping track of these rules at this point, but whatever.
The gods are.
Yeah. But yeah, then Matt Damon's just like winging it. He's just like, okay, yeah, I'm just going to try killing everyone and maybe it's all going to work out. And you know, that's
and then I just started blasting, basically.
blasting.
And he did. And he did. Arrow by arrow by arrow.
Yeah. Okay, guys. Any other thoughts on anything I didn't bring up that we want to discuss?
There's a large swath of the movie that we skipped over, which is dudes on a boat. Mm-hmm. And I loved all the dudes on the boat stuff.
They built those boats, and those boats had giant sails. Like the work it took just to lift those sails in those early scenes. Man, we don't need AI. Human effort has made this movie.
The sequence where they're like, well, let's stop here. And he's like, I don't think we should stop there. He's like, but we need to eat. And he's like, yeah, there's a bunch of delicious cows. Don't touch any of those delicious cows.
Yeah.
And I love how we're waiting on the wind to change, and it won't change. And then we eat the delicious cows. And then, you know, I just thought that last hour of this movie, I think nearly flawless. You know, as much as the first hour didn't work for me, I was so won over by the final hour of the movie where, you know, the last sequence of basically everything from Samantha Morton on in the movie is just banger after banger after banger. And, you know, by the time we're like getting home and then we have all of, you know, Matt Damon back and dealing with all that stuff, I think the movie really finds its groove. But I loved all the men on the boat. I love all of the, you know, whittling them down.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the things they have to deal with, the whirlpool, the creature, all, it's just all so great.
Yeah. There's so much texture. By the way,
I do want to point out they did build boats, as Devinger points out, but they also used existing ships as well for the movie. So they're not all completely built for the ship.
That's fine, but they're still boats.
They're real.
They're not like projections of the volume in the background. Like they're
real. He apparently filmed at sea as well for parts of the film. And
basically,
so,
my understanding is exactly the same way they filmed live action Moana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Not the problem with this one, though, not enough rock in this one. Not enough Dwayne
Johnson.
That's
what I said.
I know.
That's what you said.
That's what you
said. After walking out of Moana, that's what you're saying. If Hercules was in the story somewhere, sure. That's what The Rock is for. He was already Hercules once.
I don't know, man. I think in the right hands. The problem is The Rock is never used right. Maybe that's part him problem.
I think he doesn't want to be used right. Yeah.
I don't think Christopher Nolan had any interest in that at all. But man, and Matt Damon's great. I'm not saying Matt Damon's not great. I think The Rock could have done it. I think he could have done
what
it.
What is it about Matt Damon? We got to get this guy home. Saving Private Ryan.
It doesn't matter who else dies or what money we spend. We got to get this dude home.
So I wasn't a huge fan of the earlier characterizations of Odysseus. I think because of the reveal we get at the end, the idea is that war has damaged him. He's walking onto the shore shell-shocked after the sacking of Troy. By the way, sacking of Troy has one of the best shots I've ever seen in a film when he goes to the gate and he drops like the coals
fire
or whatever. Yeah. And then boom, it like illuminates like all the soldiers
dudes
outside the gate.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Amazing. Amazing.
What about the shot where they finally open the gates and we just keep that camera on the ground and everybody runs past.
Everyone runs around.
And then incredible. Benny Safdie shows up. Yeah. At the end.
For some reason, the guy from Good Time is there. Anyway. So he's like shell shocked, but then like the version we get of Odysseus is cocky and I want to experience the sirens. Let's go into the Cyclops cave. Like it's such like a cocky version of him. And so I understand the idea of like, he's cocky. He thinks he's all that. And then he gets like humbled by everything that happens and needs to build himself back up. Mm-hmm. That through line didn't really work for me upon this first viewing, because at the end, he's like, he's supposed to have already achieved that point by the beginning of the film.
Well, that's where the convoluted time
right
telling works against you.
I agree. So maybe I'm picking too many nits, but the reveal that that's why he didn't want to go home at the end of the film is like, oh, well, then none of his behavior made any sense.
Because at the beginning of the movie,
maybe you can be PTSD from war and also cocky. Maybe that's.
I don't think you're supposed to unpack it took that.
It takes a while. It takes 7 years with Cersei, or not Cersei, with the other one, Calypso, to unpack that. 7 years of just holding hands on the beach. That's all they did. That's what Christopher Nolan wants us to think. Charlize Theron's like, you know, we could do many more things. Nope. I'm good.
They don't even hint at it. Okay, anyway, go ahead. So any other thoughts? And so the movie ends, I think, quite beautifully with them heading off and him wanting to honor the men whose lives he carelessly wasted during the course of the Odyssey.
Bye, son, I'll never see you again because now I'm exiled.
Right.
Or at least he will not see him for a very long time.
Yeah.
Did they even wonder, like, putting Tom Holland and Zendaya in a movie together? Did we, like, guys, come on. Can we be a little more creative here? I don't know. I like Zendaya
quite a bit. This is the second movie that they will be in this summer together.
This summer.
They never see each other.
Half $1 billion.
They never see each other in this movie.
They never see each other in this movie. They just got married. I feel like every little bit of this, I was talking to Dave about this. Logan Marshall Green is in this movie of Upgrade fame. Yeah. The other guy who kind of looks like Tom Hardy. And he replaced Cosmo Jarvis, the other guy who looks like Tom Hardy. Was Tom Hardy just busy? Too busy to hang out with Chris Nolan again? It seems like he really wanted Tom Hardy in this movie.
I'm going to put this out there, guys. They should have built the Trojan horse more inland.
Yeah.
You know, like, why build it on the beach where someone can drown at the bottom of the horse?
That's where all the stuff was. That's where all the pieces of the ship was.
You can move the stuff a lot easier before you build it.
Before you build it, it's the easiest time to move it.
Yeah.
It's true. It's like, don't build your bouquets outside of the room where you want to put it.
I would have given anything for just a one shot of them building the horse. Because it is a spectacular build,
incredible build.
You know,
with one guy just like, you know, I'm really good at building model animals, and I think I can just expand this. I think I could just like scale it up. You know,
there's one guy who's useless as a sailor, but man, what a sculptor!
And they probably took the like figurehead of a ship to be the horse's head. That's probably what I'm assuming. I don't know because it looked extra deep.
Completely unexplained in every way.
Unexplained. Whatever. But shout out to, I just love everybody we see here. Again, I was so happy to see John Leguizamo in this movie.
Yeah, he was great in the film. And the moment, and he has a really nice laugh line at the end too, when he says, what happened? Is he dead?
I know, it's funny. I think it's off camera. I think it's like just his voice.
He's like in the background out of focus. He's like, is he dead?
Did we win?
What happened?
Did he win? Did he win the fight? It's so great.
And yeah, there's a bunch of moments like that are only possible when you have the kind of modernization that he attempted in the film. Now, whether that's worth the trade-off of it being very jarring for folks like Jeff, and I don't think Jeff is the only one, you know, you'll have to decide. So
you'll see.
At the end of the day, it is really impressive that Christopher Nolan made a movie.
The movie.
And that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of The Filmcast. You can find more episodes of the show at thefilmcast.com. Email us at filmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from Tim McCune from The Midnight. Our spoiler bumper and weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode, with video assistance provided by Kurt Mega and John Barry. Hey, it turns out that a lot of people don't want to release a movie right after The Odyssey comes out. There are some movies coming out next week, but instead of choosing a movie in theaters, we are going to check out a new movie coming out on Paramount Plus.
A surprise release. We didn't expect this.
I mean, even if there was movies coming out in theaters, I'd argue for this movie. I'm that excited.
Yeah.
Streaming July 25th on Paramount Plus, Avatar Aang, The Last Airbender.
Woo!
Woo! Woo! So look forward to that, folks. It should be a fun conversation. Until then, they are Devendra Hardwar and Jeff Cannata. I'm David Chen, and we'll see you later. Goodbye.